take it away.
Well, thanks, Kate, for the Charity and Security Network and for Interaction hosting us today. It's an important discussion, and I am totally impressed that Brian and Charlie and Jennifer could get through almost 150 years worth of law and codes of conduct and do it so beautifully and articulately, and then having Muhammad drive it home on the operational aspects. Not to make this an American Red Cross tutorial, but as Brian shared with you, you know, these challenges of that nexus between the U.S. government and an NGO have existed long before 9/11. One of the things as head of government relations for the American Red Cross I always had to be careful of was who wanted to wrap themselves in our banner, whether it be private industry, the U.S. government, or in some cases we did have the challenge with certain, I think, questionable charities after 9/11. And he is right. The impartiality challenge is baked into the DNA of the organization and its people. Ensuring that aid's not used to promote political agendas doesn't make you very popular. What it makes you is someone who looks at what do both sides need to do to win, if you will. What does the government need in order to fulfill its mission, whether that's the Treasury Department, whether that's the Department of Homeland Security, what does the NGO need to do to fulfill its mission? And I think this is only going to get dicier. I think we've kind of come through a situation where pre-9/11 there were those dynamics and tensions. Post-9/11, we came into a situation where there were knee-jerk reactions, and as Charlie so eloquently laid out, here was an existing framework that basically was held at arm's length. One of my least favorite cartoons, and one that still I find heartbreaking but very true, was a picture of Rumsfeld with a big book that opened, and it was entitled The Geneva Suggestions. Well, that's where we get ourselves into trouble, is when we think that they are suggestions. Red Cross, at least in this country, has the challenge also further of alleviating human suffering from the standpoint of our charter, I believe, is unique in that we also provide emergency communications for armed services. So on the one hand, we're doing the international work, and this was most schizophrenic during the first Iraq War, where you would be working on emergency communications between the armed forces and their loved ones at home. At the same time, you're delivering services to refugee camps. It makes one very nimble, and it does force you to think through every action and how it's perceived. I think one of the challenges, and Charlie, I hope we kind of get a chance to get into this, is we have had in previous decades the luxury of high contracting parties educating their militaries. As we move now to an increasing number of failed states, what does that mean for the conventions, and how can we still work within that framework? Jennifer drove home, and I have kind of had a, I wouldn't say schizophrenic, but having served with the Red Cross as VP from 99 through 2005, I then switched to the George Washington University and was working with the Homeland Security Policy Institute, where it became incumbent to understand why the U.S. government was doing what it was doing, how was it formulating its counter-strategy, and specifically, what was it that we were doing that was, and let me use the example of, quote, the war on terror, possibly one of the worst phrases that we could have ever used because it enabled a leveling of the battlefields of, you know, an asymmetric warfare situation and did not win us any friends. And Jennifer drove home in her comments the fear as she interviewed these leaders of Muslim charities, these leaders within the Muslim community. One of the things that the Institute worked with the Department of Homeland Security was their Civil Rights and Civil Liberties Unit, working with their young Muslim leaders group to try to get some understanding. As it was said so eloquently, these are folks who should be allies in helping fight extremism, yet we were driving them away. And it was amazing to me, these college students, incredibly bright, incredibly articulate, but it took the first 2 hours to break that ice and for them to be willing to understand that people really did want to hear. And the fear was absolutely palpable in the stories that came out. Now, these are kids who've been raised in this country. You can only imagine what a first-generation individual feels. And I think, Mohammed, I haven't had to deal with the OFAC situation ourselves with Red Cross and the operational impacts. It is a challenge, but you're right. There is a different spirit in the air. One of my concern is as we move into, and I think this is that next iteration of this relationship with the U.S. government, we are focused on smart power. We're focused on the understanding that we need to move beyond military and intelligence means of defeating an extremist ideology, an extremist narrative. And that has been an awakening to the use of all other instruments of statecraft, which take everyone down the line of humanitarian assistance, development aid. Well, the challenge for the NGOs, and I hope a number of you are in the room are lobbyists for your particular charity or nonprofit, because the bottom line becomes, it's good because people are waking up to the importance of what the NGO community does to increase the nation's security, but it's going to be fraught with challenges because we have, especially when you look at DOD and when you look at Treasury with its counterterrorism strategy with financial issues, you have the distinct potential of being co-opted. We have differing missions, we have different cultures, we have differing strategic outcomes. We do not speak the same language. I met an absolutely wonderful naval captain who had been part of a group with DOD and humanitarian organizations talking about DOD support during major disasters. And he could not understand for the life of him why an NGO would not want to be called a partner. Now, if we can't get past the simplicity of lexicon, so I guess I would say to the group that, you know, one of the things that we need to do, especially with this new, I think, opening with the new administration, is to be forthright and keep pushing our agenda, just as Kay is here, to get those discussions on the table. And when you don't run through the rulemaking process, because we focused a lot on Treasury today, Treasury has used the bureaucratic tools that it has at its disposal. And by its very nature, regulatory rulemaking, you know, once it's there, it's solid. It's only like an accretion of barnacles that keeps going. We have to find a way to keep that discussion going with rulemaking bodies while at the same time bringing pressure, congressional pressure, other administrative pressure, public pressure, to kind of rethink these issues and move forward in a much smarter way.